This presentation has been previously broadcast.
The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Breaking news now in the death of Dante Wright. We're just learning charges will be filed today against the former police officer Kim Potter. She is the 26-year veteran of the Brooklyn Center Police Department who says she accidentally grabbed her firearm when she thought she was tasing Wright. Second degree murder charge will be filed against her with a maximum prison sentence of 10 years.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Well, good afternoon and welcome. It's good to be with you. Developing story. We've been monitoring and following. ABC 11 just gave you that report, and we'll dive into the controversies and the riots and what's happening in the Brooklyn Center just a little bit. Good afternoon. Thank you for joining me. It is great to be live with you this afternoon, and I'm here to, of course, give you a look at life you're not going to get anywhere else. Feel free to join us anytime. You know, my lines are always open to you at 888-914-9149. You can always join the conversation. Starting off today, there's big international news I just want to bring you up to speed on, and I don't know how you feel about our troops coming home. They've been overseas for a long time, right? 20 years. In fact, September 11th of this year is going to make the 20th anniversary of that horrific day. The Trump administration set a deadline. They wanted our troops out May 1st for complete withdrawal from Afghanistan. The Biden administration, though, didn't do really anything to meet that deadline, so now they're pushing it off to the anniversary date, to September 11th. So 30 minutes ago, President Biden said this about the decision to bring our troops home. Listen.
With the terror threat now in many places, keeping thousands of troops grounded and concentrated in just one country at a cost of billions each year makes little sense to me and to our leaders. We cannot continue the cycle of extending or expanding our military presence in Afghanistan, hoping to create ideal conditions for the withdrawal and expecting a different result. I'm now the fourth United States president to preside over American troop presence in Afghanistan. Two Republicans, two Democrats. I will not pass this responsibility onto a fifth. After consulting closely with our allies and partners, with our military leaders and intelligence personnel, with our diplomats and our development experts, with the Congress and the Vice President, as well as with Mr. Ghani and many others around the world, I've concluded that it's time to end America's longest war. It's time for American troops to come home. When I came to office, I inherited a diplomatic agreement, duly negotiated between the government of the United States and the Taliban, that all U.S. forces would be out of Afghanistan by May 1, 2021, just 3 months after my inauguration. That's what we inherited, that commitment. It's perhaps not what I would have negotiated myself, but it was an agreement made by the United States government, and that means something. So in keeping with that agreement and with our national interest, the United States will begin our final withdrawal on May 1 of this year.
All right. According to the Wall Street Journal, even with a departure date, you know, months later, officials are concerned about whether or not, you know, the U.S.-backed government in Kabul can prevent a resurgent Taliban from controlling swaths of the country. And that's the big concern. That's something that will be watched. One of the things you don't want to see is these extremist groups operating there again and undoing all of the advances in governance and undoing all the sacrifices of the past 20 years, all the treasure that we spent there as well. As you know, there's been a lot of movement when it comes to women's rights there, and that doesn't necessarily sync with the Taliban's ideology. Taliban's also threatened to attack U.S. troops should they stay past May 1st, so they're threatening the United States of America. ABC News did a report on the pullout from Afghanistan, and here's a little bit more of what you need to know.
So there are still as many as 3,500 American troops there in Afghanistan right now, and this drawdown would bring that number to zero. It's been called America's forever war. And let me just show you the numbers. They are staggering. Take a look. More than 2,300 American troops killed in this time period. More than 40,000 Afghan civilians killed there. The cost, $825 billion. The administration says the threats have changed facing the United States in the last two decades. Al-Qaeda no longer poses a threat to the homeland, but some Republicans are pushing back right now. Mitch McConnell is saying that we are turning tail and running, saying we're abandoning our allies there. The administration says humanitarian aid will still be provided.
All right, so we'll see what happens. Let's continue to pray for a peaceful transition, and it will be good, of course, to have our troops home. On the international front and here at home as well, there seem to be some issues happening with vaccines that were quickly developed in the fight for COVID-19. The federal government has asked states to pause distribution of the J&J, you know, one-shot vaccine. You might have gotten it. One of my colleagues actually had that shot. Johnson & Johnson, apparently there have been at least six women who have developed sudden blood clots in their brains shortly after getting the vaccine. So there was also serious manufacturing issues that led J&J to dump about 15 million doses. So there's been, you know, clusters of adverse reactions to it in five states. But there's also an issue in Europe with the AstraZeneca vaccine, which also deals with blood clots. And it has led Denmark to completely remove it from the lineup of vaccines. While, you know, Health Canada says, look, the benefits outweigh the risks. They outweigh the risks. So we'll see what happens. We're going to continue to monitor what's happening with some of the side effects to the vaccines. I know a lot of people are getting them. And, you know, there have been some issues with Moderna in terms of sensitivity of the arm. And Pfizer, I saw a story last week that the South African variant, that the Pfizer vaccine is relatively ineffectual against that particular variant. But who knows? We'll see. I mean, you have so many millions of people getting, you know, inoculated, vaccinated. You know, you're going to definitely see some things. But we'll stay on it. We'll continue to look at it for you. One final story here, and then I do want to talk a little bit about what's happening within the state of Minnesota, and really an event that resonates and reverberates throughout our country. But just to the cause of life and cause of medicine and vaccines, there was one other story that came across my radar. The Health and Human Services Department announced that they're going to rescind a rule that was put into place by the Trump administration. It required women who want abortions, right? They want the abortion drug RU486 to, well, basically see a physician in you know, in a face-to-face setting. So they're pregnant, they want this, they have to see a doc. Instead, HHS is now allowing those drugs to be dispensed through a telemedicine consult. So, you know, the doctor or nurse practitioner or physician assistant, you know, they won't be able to evaluate the patient in person. Then they may never figure out exactly, you know, where she is in her pregnancy, and they won't, you know, get her, you know, like maybe blood pressure or any of the other basic health, you know, measurements. They're just going to dispense this drug by actually putting it in the mail. And I think it's troubling. I really do. It's tragic where we are. I feel like sometimes we take a step forward and then two back when it comes for the fight for life in this country. And then HHS, too, is also proposing revising Title 10 by allowing taxpayers to pay for abortions, even more than, you know, what Congress did under the last COVID relief bill. But, you know, that proposed rule change is now up for public comment. And, you know, I've posted, you know, a link, and we'll try to get a link up for you a little bit later. I'll see if I can track one down. My producer, Tom, was trying to get that. And if we can get it, we'll make you aware of it, and then you can post your own comments there as well. Coming up in just a second, too, Ed Morrissey is going to be joining me. And, of course, we will take, you know, your calls and comments for him. Our number here, 888-914-9149. It's 888-914-9149. I need to take a very short break, so stay with me. I'll be back with more right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
It was a choice that was made far, far above my pay grade.
The issues that matter most.
Actively engaged in terrorism.
Right here.
Make America moral again.
The Drew Mariani Show is live on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, it's great to be back with you. Thank you for tuning in. A lot happening in our country. The shooting of Dante Wright by Brooklyn Center, Minnesota police officer Kim Potter has touched off more rioting, with police having to deal with it last night for the third time in a row. And Potter, who along with the police chief, Tim Gannon, resigned. I was surprised. I heard Tim Gannon in a press conference say, they asked him, will you resign? And he said no. But you can tell the pressure has mounted. She's going to be charged, as you heard Mary Graham report, with second-degree manslaughter. It's Minnesota's equivalent of involuntary manslaughter. For a quick review of what's happening with this accidental shooting of Dante Wright, here's more from CBS.
This police body cam footage shows the final moments of 20-year-old Dante Wright's life. Officers attempt to handcuff Wright after a traffic stop, when Wright struggles to get back in his car. Another officer comes to help. But it was a gun, not a taser, that she fired. Wright managed to speed off, traveling a few blocks before crashing into another car. Authorities tried to revive him, but he died at the scene. Police Chief Tim Gannon described the shooting as an accidental discharge.
It is my belief that the officer had the intention to deploy their taser, but instead shot Mr. Wright with a single bullet.
So that was the police chief. Potter and Gannon aren't the only ones to lose their job. The city manager was fired by the mayor because he called for due process to be allowed on the whole question of whether or not Potter would be fired. The city council voted to remove the manager from his job, not because he was doing a bad job, but because the members apparently didn't want rioters coming to their houses. And that really is the heart of what I think was motivating a lot of this these actions. After the first night of rioting, the governor, Tim Walz, he declared a curfew for almost the entire Twin City metro area from 7 p.m. at night all the way to 6 a.m., even though the rioting was only happening in Brooklyn Center and other parts of Minneapolis. And that curfew, that declaration, didn't go over well. And, of course, it was not reimposed last night. Instead, they let the municipalities handle it on their own. I'm joined right now by a citizen of Minnesota, Ed Marcy, senior editor at hotair.com, and it's good to have him back for his analysis and insight. Ed, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Drew. Thanks for having me on again.
Thank you. No, I enjoyed our first conversation on this situation. A lot is, of course, unfolding and developing.
Right.
It was obvious from the video that Officer Potter, well, at least that's the way I saw it. I don't have all the details, but she was shouting, taser, 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 and she pulled her firearm, her service weapon, and fired that instead of the taser. This has happened in the past. How's it been handled legally in the past, and what do you make of how all this is now playing out?
Yeah, this is there's a couple of very clear issues that are in play here. One is that this is actually an extremely rare event for a police officer to fire a firearm when intending to deploy a taser. It's happened, I think Andy McCarthy over at National Review said that there may have been as many as 20 incidents over the last 20 years. But it's exceedingly rare. And there have been police officers who have been charged for this because it's really on the police officers to perform their duties correctly. You can't deploy lethal force when there is no threat to, there's no reasonable fear of loss of life or grave bodily harm to yourself or people around you. And in the video, you can hear her say, taser, 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 which tells us that she was recognizing that there was no lethal issue involved here. She was using a non-lethal compliance technique to try to get him back into custody. That leaves her at risk for a manslaughter charge in this particular case. And once I saw the video, I think that and others saw it as well. I mean, it became very clear that she needed an attorney and she needed it immediately. That's part of the due diligence that police officers or anybody has to use. I mean, even if you're talking about people who are in a situation where they're trying to defend themselves, you can't use lethal force without there being a reasonable threat to your life or to the life of somebody that you're with Or a reasonable fear of grave bodily injury. And that differs a little bit from state to state, but that's conceptually how lethal force and self-defense works. And the police have basically the same thresholds to meet. They just have a wider scope of who they're protecting. And if you don't have lethal force, you can't deploy lethal force. And if you do, you're liable to be charged.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. We'll see how this plays out. A lot of feedback from AOC and others.
Yes.
I think she said this was the death resulted from, and I want to quote her tweet here, an indefensible system that grants impunity for state violence. That she says this was not a random disconnected accident.
This is nonsense, Drew, because, I mean, you can look at the infrequency in which this happens again.
Yep.
I mean, this goes back, I mean, this kind of cuts both ways. I mean, it certainly cuts against Officer Potter's chances of mounting an effective defense against this charge, but it also cuts against the idea that this is something that is happening systemically. It's happened maybe 20 times over 20 years. It is clearly an accident in that sense. It is an unusual event. In fact, it's an extremely rare event.
Yeah.
And to say that this is somehow representative of policing in our communities is absurd. It's absolutely absurd.
First of all, it doesn't resonate well with people at all. Last November, after a string of, you know, these progressive Democrats failed to win at the polls, this whole, you know, defund the police effort, you could see people moving away from it. Joe Biden did the same thing. What's happening right now? I mean, this, you know, efforts have been to, you know, defund the police, bring in social workers, et cetera. And then you saw a lot of states begin to throw money back at their police departments. Is that mantra going to be reiterated again? Are people going to move to defund the police because this happened?
Well, I think you're going to hear people talking about it, right? I mean, they're talking about it here. Not so much here. They're talking about it in other places. Not so much here because the city council in Minneapolis tried to do that, and it sent so many bad signals. They cut the funding for a new class of recruits. You had a number of officers that left the job. One way or another, they left the job, and they're down about 25% on manpower now. And the result of this is catastrophic. You've got murders going through the roof. You've got violent crime going through the roof. And the people in the communities that are most impacted by this are those that are supposedly being protected by the idea of abolishing the police. Those neighborhoods want police there. They just want police to do their jobs right. And I think that's fair. I think that they deserve that.
Your governor, Governor Waltz, decided to impose a blanket curfew on the Twin Cities metro area. Got a lot of backlash for that. What happened, and why did he decide not to do that the second night? What changed his mind?
Well, there were curfews in both nights. It was the scope of the curfew that that people were objecting to. If you know the Twin Cities, they included Dakota County in the curfew. And Dakota County is on the opposite side of the metro area from where Brooklyn Center is. Dakota County doesn't even touch Minneapolis, let alone Brooklyn Center. So there's really not, I mean, it was a 7 p.m. curfew in Dakota County for no purpose whatsoever. Last night's was 10 p.m. and it was more just centered in Hennepin, Anoka, and Ramsey. I would not be surprised if they didn't have another one tonight in those areas, though, because, again, they had unrest last night and they had trouble dealing with that. I would not be surprised if we don't see another one tonight.
Wow. Ed, I know you've got to run in about a moment here. I'm curious about one other thing, and that's the Derek Chauvin trial. You know, tensions are so high in your city right now. I mean, it's
yes.
You know, with the death of George Floyd, we saw what happened, you know, in the Twin Cities. My heart goes out to that area because it's such a beautiful city, such a great city. And now you've got this trial. I would hate to be this officer right now in the midst of all this. The trial supposedly winding down. It's expected that Chauvin's going to be convicted. I don't know what charge. That's not clear yet. What do we expect to happen after the jury has reached its decision? And I know they are not sequestered. How is all this playing out in terms of that case?
Yeah, they're not sequestered, and they should have been right from the very beginning. They should have been sequestered on Monday after this erupted in Brooklyn Center. And they're going to be sequestered for closing arguments. That had been the plan all along, that that the jury would be sequestered when closing arguments begin. That'll be on Monday, apparently. But what happens after that? I think you're going to see Governor Waltz flood the zone with National Guard again, which is, if he's smart, he'll do that, because it's good to have that out on the street in order to just tamp down any sort of violence that might occur. I'm leaning towards the idea that there's going to be a conviction in this case, which makes it makes it probably a little less problematic, but you never know. I mean, juries are interesting, things, and they are tough to predict.
Well, Ed, thank you. Thanks for your time and for your insight. I know we'll be talking again in the not-too-distant future. I'm going to ask everybody to pray for Ed and for his family. I know he would appreciate that as well.
Thank you very much.
Ed, we'll catch up with you, okay?
That sounds great, Jim.
Thanks. Appreciate it. That's Ed Morrissey. And do say a prayer for him. Ed's a great guy. Look, we all need prayer, right? And, you know, I just will ask you, just on a personal level, right now, if you could say a Hail Mary or an Our Father for him, I know he'd be grateful for that. So thanks for doing that. You know, this is a it's such a difficult situation. I was watching the police chief the other day get choked up when he was talking about the incident in a press conference. And if you didn't hear that, I'll just show you. I mean, this is a tough thing for law enforcement as well. I mean, it's tragic. If I was a black man in this country, you see this unfolding. I mean, there's such division. There's so much concern on so many sides of this issue. But here's the police chief. He lost his job because of what unfolded in this case. Listen to the emotion of this man.
This is what I'm here for. Okay. I'm the leader of this department. They expect me to lead, create a safe city. That's what I'm trying to do. So that's it.
I hope you're not trying to.
Okay. And I'm emotional.
Guys, he's being honest.
I'm just trying to be honest. Yeah. The only time that we return, in every situation that we had, we returned fire. So when we got pelted with bricks or frozen cans, which you've collected, we photographed the evidence. We have the evidence. We can show that to you in the future. But once we got pelted, then we responded in kind. And there was a distance that there was a distance, and everything that I understand that.
Would you do things differently?
Would I do things differently last night?
Than last night?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
All right, in the midst of all the bad news in Minnesota, of course, there were people in the streets pushing for peace. And I think that needs to be highlighted. So often we see buildings burn. We see, you know, stores and places being looted. We see incredible decision. But KRE 11 in Minnesota will tell you about one group in particular that was trying to bring about peace.
Want to try to assist best we can.
It's no secret it's been a traumatic 10 months for Minnesota and the nation as tempers flare in the wake of another deadly encounter involving an unarmed black man and police.
Everybody has a right to protest. They do. What we want to prevent is what happened last year.
Protests leading to riots and looting.
Why y'all let them do the stores like this?
We got to protect our own stuff and find a different way to express ourselves.
Try to avoid anybody trying to run in and do anything sneaky.
This is what's now forcing the city of Minneapolis's Office of Violence Prevention to reimagine the city's approach to helping communities heal after traumatic events like these.
We want to support community in thinking about de-escalation and conflict resolution if things come to that.
That's kind of what we all working for, you know?
Trahern Pollard is the founder of We Push for Peace.
We've been out here for years.
One of seven local organizations hired by the city to intervene with community members during hostile situations.
So when we out there and we see young men and women that's out there emotionally driven, traumatized, angry, we try to help them channel those emotions.
For Pollard and his team, it's about bridging the divide and building relationships.
What our objective is to bridge the gap between law enforcement and our community. We know the community very well. We live here. We work here.
A lot of traffic due to what's going on right now.
So if it means losing sleep while risking their own lives for the sake of community, they're in it for the long haul.
And when you out here doing this kind of work and you trying to save your community, man, you don't think about all that.
Yeah, you know, I applaud him. I mean, bravo. We should all be doing our part to help bring about peace, bring about unity, clear up misconceptions. I know you may not be in the Twin Cities. This may not affect you directly, but it is reverberating in many parts of the country. And what you can do, as I say all the time, is in this moment, say a prayer. I believe prayer does change things. So, today, and just changing gears, we'll continue to follow the story. Let's pray that peace continues to prevail there. But I want to deal with another issue. One of my favorite presidents is Abraham Lincoln. And I don't know if you know what today is. Do you know what happened today? It's an anniversary of a fateful event. It was 156 years ago today that President Lincoln, he was sitting in the Ford Theater in Washington, D.C., right next to his wife, Mary Todd Lincoln. And they were watching a performance of the play, Our American Cousin. And just 6 days earlier, of course, General Grant had reached terms of agreement with the Confederate General Lee and the end of the Civil War. And it really should have been time for just Lincoln to sit back and to relax. The Civil War had come to an end. The Confederate sympathizer, John Wilkes Booth, was not happy about it. In fact, in March, a little bit prior to this date, there was talk of just actually kidnapping the president, but you know what history would ultimately reveal. They decided to kill Abraham Lincoln 4 days earlier at Lincoln's last speech, but that didn't happen. So Booth conspired a couple of guys to take out Lincoln. And they wanted to also assassinate the vice president, Andrew Johnson, and the secretary of state, William Seward at the time. And Booth snuck into the box where Lincoln was sitting and shot him, put a bullet in his head, shot him with a Derringer. And one of his two fellow conspirators ended up just wounding Johnson. And the other, who was supposed to kill Seward, chickened out, which is a good thing, obviously. But, Lincoln's assassination was the first time an American president was killed in office, and it's marked our nation ever since. Our four presidents, he's not the first. I mean, there have been four other presidents. Let me rephrase it. Of the four presidents who have been assassinated, the Lincoln, Kennedy, really are the two that stand out probably most vividly in your mind. They're the ones that have been seared almost into the national consciousness. Lincoln's came, of course, after the North had defeated the South, and after Lincoln had issued that very famous document, the Emancipation Proclamation. And only a couple of weeks after he had been inaugurated for his second term, the nation mourned. And you might remember the day. You might be old enough to remember where you were when John Kennedy was shot. The nation mourned. They lined up by the millions, of course, to mourn John F. Kennedy. They did the same thing for Lincoln, though. And my next guest is going to be joining me here in a second. We've spoken about this, how people lined up. They actually put Lincoln's body on tour. They lined up by the millions to view what was a funeral train that carried his body from Washington through New York State and onto Springfield, Illinois, where ultimately he was buried. So today we remember the passing, the assassination, really, of Abraham Lincoln. And I thought, to give you a little history lesson, to go back in time, what surrounded this assassination? What happened the days before? Who conspired to do this? How was it ultimately wrapped up? I've invited John Cribb back. He's an expert on Abraham Lincoln. He's the author of a recent novel, and we've talked about this a couple times. You may want to pick it up. It's called Old Abe. Old Abe, okay, by John Cribb. Cribb spelled C-R-I-B-B. And you can find him at that website, too, johncribbauthor.com. Hey, John, thanks for your time. It's always good to have you back. Good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. Thanks for having me. I really appreciate it. I always love talking to you.
Yeah, I enjoy our conversations immensely. I always learn something new. And I think, so often a lot of Americans today don't know their American history. I mean, you might know, big snapshots or big events, but they don't know sometimes the events that surrounded that. And, of course, Lincoln's assassination today, we remember, 156 years ago today. It's amazing. There have been other presidents that have been assassinated. But Lincoln's assassination seems to continue to fascinate the nation. Why is that? What was it about this particular assassination? Maybe bring us back in time. Paint the picture of what was happening and what went down.
Yeah. Well, I do think one reason it continues to fascinate people and resonate is the time and setting in which it took place, which was right at the end of the Civil War, at what should have been, for the North anyway, a time of, as you said, great celebration And I mean, our country had been saved. As you said, just on April 9th, a few days earlier, Robert E. Lee surrendered his army to Ulysses S. Grant at Appomattox. There were still armies in the field. Joe Johnson was in the process of negotiating surrender terms with William T. Sherman in North Carolina. But people knew that it was winding down. They knew that it was almost over. And so there was a lot of celebrating going on in Washington. And people were warning Lincoln, you know, this, it may seem like this is a time to relax, but passions are higher than ever right now. His Secretary of War, Edwin Stanton, was really worried about him, and his good friend Ward Hill Lamon, who kind of acted as an official bodyguard, Lincoln sent him down to Richmond on some business. But Lamon, before he left, begged him not to go out at night, and Lincoln didn't take his advice, unfortunately. So that was kind of the setting. And so I do think it happened on a Good Friday, which made it even more horrible and remarkable for a lot of people. And Lincoln was the first president to be shot, so he was an instant martyr when this happened.
Wow. I had heard, and I don't know whether this is myth or true, that he had a premonition about this. Is that true? Did Lincoln have some sort of premonition of what was going to happen a few days ahead of time?
Yeah, that story has been cast into doubt by a lot of historians, and I actually did not use that in my novel simply for that reason. If you're talking about the dream where he heard crying and sobbing in the White House, and he goes down to stairs, and there's a casket, and he says, "You know what's wrong?" And they say the president has died. It was not told until years later, and there's just some problems with it. Now, what he did have, though, another recurring dream that he had several times throughout the war, he said, of standing on a ship of some kind. It was unclear what kind it was, even to him, and moving across water toward a distant shore that kept receding in front of him. And he, the last day he was alive, he had a cabinet meeting, and he told his cabinet, and Grant was there. He said, "I've had this dream again last night, and I've had it," he said, "before every major battle, just about in the war. The night before, I've had this dream, and it always has preceded something significant." And Lincoln said, "I think that what it must mean is that Johnson is about to surrender his army to Sherman." He said, "There's nothing else significant that could happen." He said, "That's got to be it." So he did have that dream the night before he died, and that's on the authority of more than one person who attended the meeting.
Boy, that's fascinating. You know, it really is. It's coincidence? I don't know. You know, bring us back in time, if you could, John. I mean, and the fact he died on Good Friday, I didn't realize that. That's another really compelling fact. Lincoln is shot, of course, in the head. Booth, let's talk about his assassin. John Wilkes Booth was a very well-regarded actor who was loved in the South before the Civil War and during the war. I think he stayed in the North, became increasingly bitter that all audiences weren't enamored with him as they were down in Dixie. Share a little bit about who the character of Booth was. And then I know that about a month earlier, March 17th, that, with a number of other men met in a Washington bar to plan actually the abduction of the president 3 days later. So who's John Wilkes Booth? Maybe bring us back a little bit into who this man was and then how this all came about, this plan to abduct and then ultimately assassinate Lincoln.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, John Wilkes Booth was one of the most famous actors of his day. He came from a famous acting father, a family rather. His father, Junius Booth, was well known on the stage. Both of his brothers were, and he had become an accomplished, well-regarded actor. He's from Maryland, from a slaveholding family, and he was very pro-South, very pro-Confederate in his views. And he came to hate Lincoln. He viewed Lincoln as a tyrant, came to hate the North, as you said. And Booth also, it's important to understand that he was a racist and a white supremacist. And those terms get thrown around a lot these days, it seems. But he really was one. He wrote that this country was made for the white, not for the black man.
Wow.
And he wrote that slavery was one of the greatest blessings ever bestowed by God on a most favored nation. So he hated Lincoln in part because of Lincoln freeing the slaves and, as you know, Lincoln's policies. As you said, his original plan was to kidnap Lincoln. And the idea was they were going to kidnap him and somehow get him down to Richmond and hold him there, and then the South could exchange him for thousands of Confederate prisoners of war, because the South was very much in need of manpower at that time. And so, as you said, he laid these plans to kidnap and have with this small group of accomplices, and that just never really panned out. And on March 17th, yeah, of 1865, they actually were laying in wait for Lincoln. Lincoln was supposed to attend a play at a hospital outside of Washington, but Lincoln changed his plans at the last minute, so he never shows up. They're just waiting there, and Lincoln never comes. Then at the last minute, it changes to an assassination plot, and very, very near the end of the war. As a matter of fact, it may well have happened on April 11th, where Booth decides to do this. Lincoln gave the last speech of his life on April 11th, 1865, that night, and from the White House, from a window in the White House. And the crowd came thinking they were going to get a rousing victory speech, because Lee had just surrendered his army, but Lincoln instead talked to him about Reconstruction, putting the country back together again. And as he was giving the speech, he broached the idea of black suffrage, of voting rights for black people. It's the first time an American president ever, in a serious manner, started down this path. And he suggested giving it to a small portion of the black population, but he would, eventually he would have broadened that. There was somebody in the audience that night that was infuriated by that. It was John Wilkes Booth. And when he heard Lincoln talking about the idea of black suffrage, he turned to Lewis Powell, one of the conspirators, and he said, that means, and he used the N-word, he said, that means N-word citizenship. He said, by God, I will run him through, meaning I'll kill him. And he said, that is the last speech he will ever give. Wow. And two nights later, he puts a bullet through the back of Lincoln's head. So Lincoln literally, dies in this fight for civil rights, for all Americans, but in particular African Americans.
Wow. And that's something I don't know a lot of people are aware of. What an amazing legacy Lincoln left behind. I have to take a break in a minute here, but I'm curious about his guard. The president did have a guard at the time. The guy's name was John Parker. Why wasn't he there? What happened that he was not guarding the booth, and it could have prevented the assassination of Lincoln?
Yeah, and of course there's been debate about that over the years. John Parker was really a White House guard more than a presidential bodyguard, and his job really was just to get Lincoln to the theater and then away from the theater. And he, of course, was not prosecuted for leaving his post, because he was not there when John Booth went into the booth, went into the presidential box. And he said that Lincoln told him he could go. He said, go enjoy the play. And I think instead he went next door to have a drink. But security by today's standards was almost non-existent.
Yeah, right. And then the president had a friend in the box as well, who attempted to grab Booth, didn't he? And she was cut or slashed. Who was that?
Yeah, Major Henry Rathbone was, and his fiancée were with the Lincolns. And after Booth shot Lincoln, Rathbone tried to grab him, and Booth pulled out a knife and cut him pretty badly before leaping out of the box onto the stage.
Well, I'll tell you, John, stay with me. When we come back, we'll pick it up there. Booth, of course, injured his leg when he jumped onto the stage to escape, but he managed to hobble outside to his horse. And we'll pick up the rest of the story. You may not know all the details of what happened on this fateful day 156 years ago when President Abraham Lincoln was assassinated. We'll tell you more right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forrester.
It's like a civics class on the radio. The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
The eyes have seen the glory of
Well, it was 156 years ago today that President Abraham Lincoln, sitting in the Ford Theater there in Washington, D.C., hoping to relax with his wife, watched a performance of a play, and it would be the last show he'd ever watch. In fact, John Wilkes Booth, who was not happy with Abraham Lincoln, as you've heard from my guest today, John Cribb, snuck into the presidential box and put a bullet in his head. And then, in an effort to get out, there was an attempt to restrain him, but he jumped out of the box. He landed on the stage, and there he ended up injuring his leg. And as he hobbled out, he made his way, I guess, to a horse, and then the manhunt began. And here to fill us in on all the details is John Cribb. And these are fascinating details. There's so much to go on with the other assassins as well. John is the author of a great book. You can check it out. It's called Old Abe. He's an expert on Abraham Lincoln. And his website's johncribbauthor.com. I'm sure you can go online and find that book as well. Again, it's called Old Abe. If you're intrigued by the life and the legacy of Abraham Lincoln, that is well worth a read. It's enjoyable and it's an easy read. John, let's pick it up where we left off. Wilkes assassinates the president. He tries to leap out of the box and escape to safety, but he gets injured as he does. What happened next?
He flees the theater out the back door, and he crosses the Navy Yard Bridge of the Anacostia River and heads into southern Maryland. He meets up with another one of the conspirators, Davy Harold. They stop off at a tavern, the Surratt Tavern, to pick up some guns that they had stashed there waiting for them. And then they go by the house early in the morning, the next morning, 4 a.m., they stop by the house of Dr. Mudd, who's a farmer and doctor, tobacco farmer and doctor in southern Maryland. And he sets Booth's leg in a splint and gives him a crutch. And then they go on, and they want to get across the Potomac River to get into Virginia, because Booth, he thinks that if he gets down to Virginia that he'll be welcomed as a hero. He finds out that's not going to be the case, but the Potomac River is a big, wide river down in that part of the world, and it takes them a while to get across. They hide out in a pine thicket for a few nights while federal combing the area, and then they finally get across the river. They end up at a farm owned by a guy named Richard Garrett, and by this time they're posing as men who have just gotten out of the Confederate Army or trying to make their way home. And so the Garretts put them up, but they become suspicious of them, and they make them sleep in a tobacco barn. And this is the place where the federal troops close in on them. They've been tipped off, but they're there. And they demand that Booth come out. Booth won't come out. David Harold does. He surrenders, but Booth won't come out. They set the tobacco barn on fire. And then one of the soldiers, Boston Corbett, shoots Booth through the neck and paralyzes him from the spine down. Wow. I'm sorry, from the neck down. They drag him out of the barn, and a few hours later, he dies on the porch of the Garrett farm. He whispers, he says, "Tell my mother I died for my country." And then he, according to some of the reports there, he asks the soldiers, as I say, he's paralyzed. They ask him to hold his hands up their face, and he says, "Useless, useless." And then he dies. So that's the end of him.
Wow.
So, but as you say, the story of the conspiracy and the assassination and the manhunt and the other attempted assassinations, there's just so much to it. It's a fascinating saga. You can see why people are so fascinated about it, as you said, and why they can get sucked into it so easily.
There's another, and I don't recall this with vivid detail, so maybe you can fill me in on this. There was a woman conspirator, too. Hanged in Washington, and her execution, I think it was Mary Surratt, I think was her name.
Surratt.
Surratt. It's believed by some to have been, they thought it was a miscarriage of justice. What was her role? And of course, you had Lewis Payne and David Harold. You had some of the other characters that were also involved there, but she in particular stands out in my memory. What role did she play? Yeah. And I know they hung the rest of these people or hanged them. What happened?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's been a big question. People debated this over the years. Exactly how guilty was she? What did she know? She was a widow, a Confederate sympathizer, and she had a boarding house on H Street in Washington, not far from the White House. And it was a kind of safe house for these conspirators. Booth and the other conspirators met there, laying their plans. And one of her and her son, John Surratt, was one of the conspirators on the plan to kidnap Lincoln. Now, he had apparently gone on and was not even in town the night of the assassination. But Mary Surratt claimed that she knew nothing about what they were actually plotting. She knew they were meeting, but she didn't know what they were planning. They had no idea they were planning to kill the president. But the military tribunal that tries all the conspirators doesn't leave her. And there are some fingers pointing in her direction. The morning of the assassination, she, at John Wilkes Booth's request, took a package down to her tavern in the country that she was leasing out to somebody, and he asked to give it to him. And that's where he had stored these rifles he was going to go get as he fled Washington. And according to the man who was running the tavern, she showed up with this package that had some knockers in it, and she said, "Have those shooting irons ready tonight. Some parties will be calling for them." If that's true, she knew something was up. And then the other damning piece of evidence against her was that on April 17th, the night that the federal officials came to arrest her, Lewis Powell, also known as Lewis Payne, shows up in the middle of the night at her place looking basically for help. Yeah. And they're immediately suspicious of him and arrest him. But they say to her, "Have you ever seen this man before?" And she says, "I've never seen this man before in my life," which wasn't true. He had been, you know, one of the conspirators meeting at her boarding house. She claimed in the defense trial that it was dark, her eyesight, it was bad, which it was, and that he was in a kind of a disguise, which he was, and that she just claimed didn't recognize him. They do find her guilty, but the military tribunal finds her guilty, but then they do vote by a 5-9 vote to offer her to extend clemency to her and change the sentence from hanging to life in a prison. But that that application for clemency, Andrew Johnson never signs. He claimed that he never saw it. He never got it. There were people who disputed that at the time and said, yes, he did. He just didn't want to sign it. But he never signs it. It never comes. And so she hangs. She's the first woman ever executed by the federal government.
Yeah, fascinating. My guest today, John Cribb, if you want to join us, I only have a few moments. The number here is 888-914-9149. Ann is listening in California. Ann, hi, you're on the air with John Cribb. Welcome.
Hi. Actually, he pretty well answered a lot of my questions.
All right.
Because of Mary Surratt, it was hard to get all the facts with that.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the key issues with her was that she was not tried by a jury of her peers. She wasn't a member of the military. And the case was interesting as far as that was concerned. It was obvious. I had read the book, The Killing of Lincoln, and it was obvious that John Wilkes Booth was almost a depraved individual, and what happened was just horrific.
Yeah.
But then on the other hand, the justice for Mary Surratt seemed a little unclear. So
go ahead, John. I'll let you respond.
Yeah, that's right. Those are all good points. It was a military tribunal, which a lot of people thought should have been a civilian court, not a military tribunal. But the government argued this is a time of war, and Secretary of War Stanton wanted a military tribunal, and that's what he got. But yeah, all that is correct. And as I say, people over the years have debated whether Mary Surratt deserved to hang. A lot of people looking at the case said no, that she shouldn't have hung. But she was the government's theory was if you knew about the conspiracy and did not do anything to stop it, you were just as guilty as the man who pulled the trigger. That's why they hung those conspirators. One word from Mary Surratt could have stopped the whole thing, and she never spoke up.
Yeah.
About it. And that's
she had a son named John, and my understanding is that he was eventually tracked down in Egypt, right? And then brought back for trial, and he was acquitted.
Yeah.
What happened with him? I mean, what was his role?
Well, he was in New York State when the night of the assassination, according to witnesses. But he knew as soon as he heard about it, he was in trouble because he was a known associate of Booth. So he hightails it to Canada. And from there crosses the Atlantic, and he ends up, believe it or not, in the Vatican working as a papal guard, a Zouave guard for the Pope. And then somebody there recognizes him, and so he's arrested. He escapes, makes his way to Egypt. He's arrested again. They bring him back, and they try him in 1867, but they try him in a civilian court, and he gets a hung jury.
Wow.
And so he's released, and he lives out the rest of his life. I think he lived to be 72 years old. So he outlives his mom by many years. A lot of people really had hard feelings toward him because they felt like if he had come back, his mother would not have hung. He claimed he'd never imagined they would hang his mother. He didn't know that she was in that kind of danger, of that kind of penalty.
Wow. It's a fascinating story. It's a wonderful story to read and to know. And you know, John, I'm so grateful for your ability to re-educate America on so much of our history. And your book is out. I know it is just it's relatively new. It just came out, and people can get it, I'm assuming, at all major bookstores or your website as well, johncribbauthor.com. What's the best way to get Abraham Lincoln?
You know, all the usual ways. Amazon, BarnesandNoble.com. I tell people to support their independent, local independent bookstores if they can, but Barnes & Noble is also a great place. So just all the places. But I do, you know, in this day of an age when they're wanting to tear statues of great American icons down, let's remember Lincoln died fighting for our country, for our principles, and he was one of the ones that led the effort to free millions of enslaved Americans and advance civil rights. So people need to take a step back and remember that. We need more statues of Abraham Lincoln, not fewer.
Yeah, I'm with you. Hey, thank you, John. Great to talk to you today. I'm so grateful for your time. John Cribbs, an expert on Abraham Lincoln. He wrote a book called Old Abe. And as he said, you know, check your local bookstore. If not, it's available everywhere. I'm Drew Mariani. Got to take a short pause. Stay with me. When we return, we'll pray the chaplain.
We have seen surveys from any number of reputable organizations that showed that during the pandemic, even those who didn't identify with any faith were starting to believe.
Whatever reason he has, he's using this time to draw us closer to him. As people's stress level rises, the only person and thing to resort to is God, right? God is the only thing that makes sense.
Morning Air, 5 a.m. Central on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.